Hey, it's Tony Bruschi along with Jenny and Carol Hughes inviting you to come check out our brand new podcast, Office Horror Stories.
You don't get a fart in my presence. It just leave it.
When I pick up a cup, I try to take a sip. It's Greg's chew. Like, spit take right into the screen.
Gross.
I know. You can't unhear that.
It's a show jam-packed with stories of crazy bosses, insane coworkers, and workplaces from hell.
I'm seriously getting in trouble right now for being a hard worker.
Pick your ear, nose, rub your eye that clearly probably is pink eye. Here, let me handle those apples for you.
So not only is it gross that you're getting bacteria onto the money, but you're getting bacteria up into something else.
And the best part, you're invited to share your workplace nightmare or office horror story as well. Just search Office Horror Stories wherever you download podcasts, click subscribe, and start binging away now.
You know, I'm single, and then I listen to stories like that, and I'm like, that person found someone.
What? You've been carrying on a not-so-discreet affair with one of the day shift supervisors and had skipped town with her and literally thousands of dollars of client money that had been earmarked for employee incentives.
I wish I had a kid. Because if I had a kid, I could call in sick a lot, I could leave early a lot, and not saying that they were making it up. But yes, I have worked with people who made that shift.
Our brand new podcast, Office Horror Stories. New episodes weekly, available wherever you download podcasts. Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com/Grave10 and use code Grave10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/Grave10 and use code Grave10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Today on The Grave Talks, attached to the dead, the Sam Baltruses story. Sam Baltruses has lived what some may call a haunted life. From a very young age, Sam realized that he had the gift of being able to hear and sometimes see the other side. Ghosts, spirits, and the undead were just another part of everyday life for Sam. Then one night, after giving a historical performance in Salem, Sam found himself closer to the spirit world than he ever thought possible. Sam discovered that he had taken on the attachment of an angry spirit who nearly killed him. This is the haunted story of Sam Baltruses and his experiences with the dead.
So going way back to my childhood, I mean, I was pretty much like the kid from The Shining. So I was little Danny Torrance. With sensitivity at an early age. So my first technical encounter was with my grandfather. This is after he passed, which when I was really young when he passed. And I saw a man with glasses sitting on the corner of my bed, looking at me in a very warm way. And it didn't scare me. It was actually it was warm and kind of fuzzy. And I described the spirit to my mother. And she's like, that's your grandfather. And I'm like, oh. And, you know, from then it was, I would say like sensitivities to the paranormal. My mother would just say that I was sensitive. She wouldn't say sensitive to the paranormal, but I was definitely sensitive to the paranormal at an early age. Things got, as a young child, kind of like Danny Torrance or like The Sixth Sense, I got to the point where it was getting scary. To the point where I put on what I call paranormal blinders. So I had so many terrifying like visits from spirits that are like not like my grandfather, not a warm spirit like my grandfather, that terrified me. So I became really scared. And this was early on, as I put on the paranormal blinders for many years, even up until like my 30s. And I kind of just dealt with activity. I tried to shrug it off. So, for example, I lived in New York City for about 10 years. I was walking by Washington Square Park. I felt a hand grab my leg as I walked by. And this turns out that this was a mass grave site for tuberculosis patients in New York City. Had no idea. Thought maybe it was a homeless person or someone playing a joke on me. I wasn't really sure what it was. So those kinds of things happen throughout my life. It wasn't really until I would write the kind of like the typical, I was a journalist for about 20 years. And I would write the typical like Halloween haunted story. And one of those stories turned into my first book, which was Ghost Lawson.
When you say paranormal blinders, we hear that quite often of people almost saying, you know, they flipped the switch or they turned it off when they have that level of sensitivity, because it can be so overwhelming and unwanted in many cases. Some want it, some understand it right off the bat, some it's too much. Can you describe that for me in a little greater detail about how that works? Is it literally like you stop being sensitive to things, or is it just there's so much of it, it's almost white noise, and after a while you're just it's not standing out to you as much as in the past, as if you live next to a train track, the sound of the train pretty, you know, it stands out the first couple months you're there, but eventually, oh, I didn't even realize a train was going by. Is it like that? Explain it to us.
It's pretty much like that. So you become desensitized to the activity. So spirits were like reaching out to me at a young age. I would have really prophetic dreams, 7, 8 years old. And I remember looking back on those dreams, like those were like downloads. They weren't actual dreams that kids should have, you know, like they were like very kind of some of them were terrifying. So that along with having that sensitivity, I blocked it out. Like if something would happen, like let's say someone was trying to reach out to me, I would literally shut it down and kind of hide from it. As I got older, I actually started drinking alcohol to kind of deal with it. So I would actually use alcohol as like self-medication to deal with the sensitivity. And again, it was just sort of like, oh, maybe I'm crazy, or maybe like I wasn't really sure what it was, but I decided to kind of push it all away. It wasn't until actually I got sober, which was about 10 years ago, that it kind of, the gates opened up for me again, in a sense that I was able to accept that I actually have abilities. And I, you know, then I'm like, well, I have this gift. Why be afraid of it? And so I actually started approaching spirits like I did as a journalist. So I'd actually interview the ghost, and that became my first book.
And tell me about that experience with that first book, and how did it come about as far as the topics of it?
Well, it was called Ghost of Boston. So it was based on my article for a magazine that I wrote called Haunted Hotspots in Boston. And it was a lot of fun to do the research, and I would hang out in cemeteries and all sorts of things. So it was a huge hit as far as people responding to it. A lot of people were like, hey, that article was fantastic, kind of thing. And then I had kind of like an epiphany in regards to like what I was supposed to do. Cause I was an entertainment journalist. So it wasn't like I did do some investigative work, as a journalist, but I was interviewing celebrities, and it was kind of the same thing over and over and over again. And I wanted something different. And so I had this actually pretty profound dream with a woman, and the woman was like, I was in this dream. It was kind of like this kind of really realistic dream. And it was like almost I went to a different dimension. And this woman wearing, I kind of relate this woman to the Like a Prayer video from Madonna. She's wearing robes, and she's just like, you must write and you don't have much time. And I'm like, okay, what does that mean?
Ominous.
So I ended up pitching the book to my first publisher, and I got the book deal the very next day.
So you begin to write this book and put it together. Where is the content coming from? I know you said in dreams, but tell me how are you getting the story for the book?
Well, my books are history books with ghost stories. Mm-hmm. So when I first wrote Ghost of Boston, it was really the whole idea behind it was for it to be a history book. Mm-hmm. And so like that, and that's kind of like the structure of my article, Haunted Hotspots in Boston, was really, it was a historical piece with ghost stories. So I'm like, I'll take that. And I started reading all the local ghost books and like all the local authors. I'm like, you know, I can do this and I can do this better. Mm-hmm. So I read everything I could first. And then I approached it like kind of like putting down the locations. And I wanted to do Salem. I wanted to do, you know, not just not just Boston. I wanted to kind of expand beyond. And my publisher was like, just focus on Boston for the first book. Mm-hmm. And that was actually really smart, because my third book on Salem was my breakthrough seller. So like that's my bestseller. So I ended up just kind of focusing on Boston, and I did a lot of research, and it was the research was pretty fantastic for that first book.
Back to our conversation in just a moment. Our supporter today, got to thank them, HelloFresh. I love these guys. Get mouthwatering seasonal recipes and pre-measured ingredients delivered right to your door with HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh makes cooking at home easy and fun. And right now, you guys can get yourself 10 free meals, including free shipping. Just go to HelloFresh.com/Grave10 and use code Grave10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. You can't go wrong with that. But why? Why would you want to do that? Well, HelloFresh recipes, they're awesome. They're delicious, you might say. You can break out of that dinner rut, and we all get into it, where you're like, well, I think we'll make this again tonight. And it's just kind of the same recycled recipes over and over. And you're like, God, I want to do something different. HelloFresh really helps you get there. You can break out of the dinner rut. 22 seasonal recipes, 22 or more, 22 plus seasonal recipes, chef curated for you every single week for you to choose from. So it's not like, oh, you only get like two or three to choose. No, this is awesome. You are going to find stuff that you love. There's something for everyone, including low-calorie, vegetarian, family-friendly recipes. Every single week, it's all there for you to pick from. HelloFresh has more 5-star recipes than any other meal kit, so you know you're getting something delicious. You save time when you do this too, okay? You're cutting out the time of going to the grocery store. You're cutting out the time of planning. You're cutting out the time of prepping. The stuff is just there for you. You're ready? Okay, time to make dinner. Everything's right here. Boom. I love it. It comes all prepackaged for you. I love how they put each individual recipe in individual bags inside the box. So you're not like, well, does this cucumber go with that? Or does this potato, am I using the wrong? No, it's all there. It's like, boom, here's what goes in this recipe in this bag. And here's your super easy to read recipe card that shows you step by step with pictures. We like pictures on how to put the meal together. It's awesome. So I have just nothing but good things to say, as you can tell. You can add extra meals or lunches even to your weekly order. Throw in the yummy sides like desserts, garlic bread, all sorts of stuff. Cookie dough is even on there. Check it out for yourself. I absolutely love HelloFresh. You should check it out for yourself. It is America's number one meal kit for a reason. Okay. And right now, you guys, because you listen to this program, can get 10 free meals from HelloFresh. Huh? Go to HelloFresh.com/Grave10 and use code Grave10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/Grave10. Use code Grave10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh.com/Grave10 and use code Grave10. Now, obviously, there's a lot of ghost stories, lore, and factual history surrounding Salem that goes to the dark, that goes to the spooky and the macabre and everything. So it's easy to understand why someone would be drawn to it if that's a topic that you're researching and reporting on. For you personally, though, what were some of the stories that really drew you in to Salem?
Well, I'll tell you, Salem for me was the book that I did not want to write. And the reason why I didn't want to write it, I thought it was over, like everyone's written a book on Salem. Mm-hmm. If you look, type it in Google, it's like 100 books on Salem. But if you really look at it, there's not a lot of books on Salem's paranormal history. And I wanted to write that book. So what drew me in initially was, of course, the horrible witch trials in 1692. There were 19 innocent men and women were hanged for witchcraft. And then one gentleman, Giles Corey, was pressed to death over a 2-day period. So I started with that, and it just kind of expanded beyond to multiple time frames in Salem, and kind of giving Salem more than just being the place where the white witches were, or witches that were innocent men and women, were executed.
Mm-hmm. Let's dive into that, because obviously when you hear Salem, the next word that comes to someone's mind is witch, and that's where everyone right. goes, and that's what's been talked about, 500 ways to Sunday. But obviously this town, this city has a much deeper and richer history than just the witch trials. Obviously, that puts it on the map, in terms of popular culture. But let's dig deeper into the paranormal history of Salem. How far back does it go, and what did you find in your research? Let's dive into some of those stories specifically that really stand out to you about Salem.
Well, I mean, it's getting back to what I was saying earlier, like there wasn't a lot written about the paranormal aspect of Salem. So everyone would say it's haunted. There was a gentleman, his name was Bob Cahill, and every city has like the one guy from the 70s or 80s that wrote the quintessential New England ghost book on that specific city. And Bob Cahill was the go-to guy in the 70s and 80s. So I actually read all of his books, and it's changed dramatically from that time. I think people would kind of like look at ghost stories as kind of like ghost porn. they would like buy, especially my first book, they would buy my book and like they would want it in like a brown paper bag because they didn't want to be seen with a ghost book. Mm-hmm. And I think that's typical for New England specifically. But Salem had a lot of witch history, but they didn't have a lot of paranormal history. And I couldn't figure out why. And after like really thinking about it, if you look at the actual Salem witch trials, a lot of the evidence that was used to accuse these innocent men and women was spectral evidence. So spectral evidence is basically made up, like a ghost of so-and-so, or Goody Glover was sitting on my bed and attacked me or afflicted me. So this actual made up evidence was used to accuse innocent men and women for witchcraft.
Mm-hmm. And with those pieces of evidence that are thrown out there, and obviously many completely innocent people died in the Salem witch trials. But when you started to dig deeper into the history of actual paranormal events, what did you find as far as what were factual ghost stories, of the area that go back to however far back you want to go with this? I'm not sure if they document things going that far back or if it's all littered with the witch stories. But what are you finding in terms of the paranormal activity that was truly paranormal activity in the Salem area?
Well, I mean, like my theory really is like that if you look at the witch trials, like the transcripts from the Salem witch trials, mm-hmm. that perhaps some of the activity that they were dealing with, they used as spectral evidence, was actual ghosts. Mm-hmm. It could have been paranormal activity. If you look at it, for example, there's testimony of people having dreams, pretty much like me, where they would have a dream, but the dreams would be used to accuse someone of being a witch. Mm-hmm. So, and if you look at some of the testimony, like for example, Bridget Bishop, when she was carted off to be hanged for witchcraft, and Bridget Bishop was the first woman to be executed and the only woman to be executed by herself, a board basically mysteriously flew from the church while she was driving by, and of course they attributed that to her being a witch. So there was paranormal activity back then. But of course there's the Giles Corey. And Giles Corey was the guy who was pressed to that, and he's been spotted before disaster. So like that's what Daniel Hawthorne writes about him. So it's the ghost lore has been part of the culture for many, many years.
Sure. Now, in more modern day, and I want to get to some of your stories, I want to talk about some of your experiences as well, but give us just some of the more standout ghost stories that you have of the Salem area when someone comes to town, someone that you know really wants to hear some of the darker stuff, maybe stuff that you may not even share with strangers or a tour or anything like that. What are some of those stories that you hold on to about Salem?
Well, I've been giving tours in Salem for about 10 years. So when I write a book, I actually usually start giving a tour first before I actually write a book. Mm-hmm. So Boston, like while I was writing Ghost of Boston, I was actually giving tours in Boston while I was writing the book. So that really helps generate, not activity, but generate stories and like giving people's feedback from the tour. So Salem is kind of similar. So I started off really, knowing the basics of the Salem witch trials, knowing some of the maritime history, but not really knowing what I know now. So it was really going out in the field, talking to people, talking to historians, talking to people about their experiences. And a lot of it came from my tour. So for example, my first ghost tour in Salem was not my tour. Like, I didn't write the tour. So I was given a script and some of it was factually incorrect. So there was one situation where I was giving a tour near Turner's Seafood, which is the Lyceum. And that's where Bridget Bishop's apple orchard was. And she was, again, the first woman that was executed. And so giving a tour, and all of a sudden I was saying that this is where her tavern was. And Bridget Bishop didn't actually own a tavern, but that's what the tour said. And that's what people were saying on the tours. So it was a historically incorrect factoid that I was given from the tour guides. Mm-hmm. So I was saying this, and then out of the blue, an apple mysteriously rolled up from behind the building and hit me on the foot. And I'm like, okay, I thought maybe it was a tour guide playing a trick on me, or wasn't really sure, but it turns out that's Bridget Bishop's apple orchard. And I do feel like there was nobody there. So there's no way that she could have, that could have been a joke. So things like that happened. That was my first experience on a tour where it was something potentially paranormal.
Mm-hmm. Why does Salem have, obviously, I know why they have the reputation of being haunted, and really a lot of it goes back to the witch trials and all of that, but deeper than that, what is it about Salem that has historically given it this hotbed, or created this hotbed of activity for everything paranormal, whether it be good, bad, and the other? What is it with the city?
Well, I mean, getting to the pressing, I mean, Giles Corey was pressed to death. He was crushed. Mm-hmm. Like, he was literally stripped down. A board was put on top of him. Rocks were put on top of the board. That's going to leave a psychic imprint on the location. So I feel like with Salem, that there is an aura of disaster that's lingering in Salem, and it's been there for 300 years. And it's something that people either feel it, or they feel drained when they go to Salem. So some people actually feel really energized, and that could be, you know, it could be the lands. It could be Native American. There's a lot of Native American backstory to Salem that people don't really talk about. It was kind of like hallowed ground for the Native Americans, and they're like, don't go there kind of thing. So I think Salem, like, I think people say like a Salem curse. And for me, I think it is, actually. I think the land is cursed.
Let's dive into that a little bit more. You think the land is cursed. Do you feel it's a Native American curse? Or what exactly, where does that stem from?
Well, I mean, I've been working on this for 10 years, and I still haven't figured it out. But there are curses associated with Salem. So, for example, Giles Corey, if you spot his specter, something bad happens to Salem. So the last time he was spotted by multiple people, which was in the early 1900s, a fire decimated Salem. So there is some, like, if you do spot Giles Corey's spirit, I would probably run because it's not good. So things like that. And I think that, you know, yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line, like, Salem just has this aura disaster that could be related to the Native Americans. It could be the fact that there were unjust killings. It's almost like, if you go to a location where, like 9/11, for example, or Auschwitz, it's going to have that same feeling. And that's what feels like for me when I go to Salem. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that there, it's where death happened.
Where you have your sensitivity level, and when you're in Salem, it has that feeling to it. Is it just an emotion? Is it an overwhelming feeling of sadness? Or are you, Sam specifically, seeing other people that have passed on, hearing voices from the other side openly, just as you, say, walk down some of the main roads?
Right. So when I first started, I had that experience with the apple, and kind of, again, having paranormal blinders, kind of like, oh, there's something explainable for that. Mm-hmm. But as the years progressed and more happened on my tours, the more and more I became, the muscle that I used for as a clairvoyant got stronger and stronger. So this is, I mean, Salem is not my only location. I've investigated, I would say, pretty much all the, especially New England, all the haunted locations. So I've been to a lot of haunted locations, But I would say that that muscle has gotten stronger and stronger because I use that muscle. So it's not a feeling. It's actually full-blown clairvoyance. Mm-hmm. When I interact with spirits now. Am I able to turn it off? Yes. And then do I turn it off on my tours? I do, but I also turn it on sometimes too.
So when you're out there and you're in Salem and you're having these experiences, is this something when you're on a tour, for example, and something happens? Has there been occurrences on the tours where you're picking up on something and the guests are not and you're pointing it out? Or are some of these things that occur on the tours so blatant that these spirits are coming out and showing everyone that they are there?
Well, I've been very lucky. People that come to Salem generally are pretty open-minded to the paranormal. So when I get tours, I try not to be like the woo-woo tour guide. I try to be basically give a history lesson with ghosts, kind of like what my original idea for writing the books. But sometimes it happens and things are just so, like the apple rolling out, like that, everyone saw that in my tour. So it wasn't something, and I think some of the people actually saw that and thought maybe it was part of the tour. So things will happen, like a cat will walk by with no tail in the middle of my tour, and like, well, they're like, what is that? I'm like, oh, it's just the cat with no tail walking by. But yeah, so it really depends on the group. I will say that some people have said it's been life-changing for them, the tour, on my tours. And a lot of it is because I let them have their, I kind of validate their experiences. So if they have the experiences on my tour and they're kind of like up-and-coming sensitives, I work with them and I'm like, hey, listen, you maybe there's a reason why you're having this reaction. That maybe you're sensitive to the paranormal. So a lot of it's kind of, it's turning to like where I'm a teacher and I'm actually teaching people how to kind of deal with the things I deal with on a normal basis. And that those tours tend to work out best. Of course, Salem is so, you know, you get so many people on your tours that sometimes you get people that are just pure skeptics, but for the most part, people that flock to Salem, especially in October, they are believers and they want to experience that with you. Do they see full-blown apparitions? Probably not. And I always tell them in October, especially when we have thousands, up to like a million people visit in October, that the spirits hide in October. If you really want to experience actual ghosts in Salem, visit off-season. Go in November. Go in January. So I tell them that, but then of course they do have experiences, and some of them are really profound. I mean, like, for example, one person on my tour, like the whole apple backstory with Bridget Bishop, she didn't know that, of course. And she was like, well, you know, I actually had a friend who got married last night, and there was their scene to their wedding at the Lyceum, which is where, like, that area was where her spirit's been spotted, and that's where her apple orchard was apples. And she was freaked out. And I bring dowsing rods, and I have dowsing rods, which are metal, kind of like, used in olden days, you use it to find water sources, but I use it to connect the spirit, and it's charged by a high priestess in Salem, and I use it for yes or no, and that really, it solidifies the communication, and people are like blown away by the dowsing rod. So it's like yes or no questions. Mm-hmm. And people like will ask questions like, you know, Bridget Bishop, are you with us? And it'll cross yes. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. They can tell that I'm actually not moving the dowsing rods.
Yeah.
So I've been using tools, and a lot of the tools are kind of like old school, not typical ghost hunter tools, although I have used ghost hunter tools too, like spirit boxes and that sort of thing. But people tend to like, especially in Salem, the more old school tools like pendulums and dowsing rods. And I mean, I even do like a grounding ceremony before. So a lot of the techniques that I'm using actually kind of border Wiccan, like witch ritual stuff.
Okay.
and they tend to like that because we're in Salem. So they want to do what the locals do. And a lot of my techniques are kind of, I combine multiple religions. I had one person on my tour asking like, what is your religion? And I'm like, well, I definitely use Wiccan ritual in a lot of my stuff, especially when it comes to banishing negative entities. But I also use, you know, a Catholic prayer. So I use all sorts of tools in my toolbox, which are different religions, to do what I need to get done when I get tours in Salem.
Mm-hmm. With there being so much spirit activity in the area, obviously you had been mentioning the ghost of Bridget earlier. That's obviously a ghost of a once living human being. What do you feel is the majority of the spirits in Salem? And I'll use the D word, which it gets overused far too often on especially on television shows, demonic.
Right.
But what are you dealing with in that town? Is it a lot of spirits of the living that were once there and are still wandering the streets? Or are there in areas darker things that maybe weren't once walking the earth?
Well, I think in Salem specifically, there's a lot of weekend witches. So when I say that, we have people who use the craft and they're conjuring things. Mm-hmm. And I say that, and of course, my friends in the Wiccan community are kind of like, they don't want to hear that. But I do think that there's a lot of conjuring going on. And when I say conjuring, it's like rituals where they don't close. And that goes for investigators too. If you're investigating a location, you need to close. Now, do I think that everything in Salem is negative? No, I think there's a lot of positive energy too, and I think a lot of it is like the especially this. I'm a high vibration clairvoyant, so when I connect with spirit, it's usually, and a lot of times I would say that I would tend to think that it's I'm talking to like Rebecca Nurse, who was one of the witch trials victims, or when the part of the Wiccan ritual, if you actually know how to do it correctly, you call them forward into your circle. So I think that that's like, there's been a lot of conjuring in Salem, and that things have been maybe kind of pulled up that may not be good. So I do think that there's, and I've been told, and I believe this, there's something inhuman in Salem, and whether it's brought in by these weekend witches or it's something that was associated with a Ouija board, I don't know, but I just know that there's something inhuman. Do I think it's the D word? No, but I think it's something inhuman.
Okay. When you're communicating with something on the other side, is it something that you have to reach out specifically with an intent of, I want to reach John Doe to communicate with in this area? Or do you have times where you're in a location and something or someone reaches out to you and says, I want to communicate here in some way, shape, or form?
Well, a lot of times it's interesting because when I give my tours, I start off at the Witch Trials Memorial. And then this is a location right next to the Charter Street Cemetery or the burying point, where a lot of people think that's where the victims are buried, but they're not actually buried there. So I go to each individual marker, and this Witch Trials Memorial was erected in 1992 to mark the 300-year anniversary of the Salem Witch Trials. So I go to each one. I start with Bridget Bishop because it's all in sequential order as to when they were executed, and I give a whole backstory. So when I'm telling their story, specifically the ones that I know a lot about, like Bridget or Sarah Good or John Proctor, I feel like sometimes they do come forward. And by me telling their story, and sometimes they'll like let me know if they don't like how I'm telling the story. For the most part, especially sometimes it can get very emotional for me. And I tell like the specifics of who they were as people. And I find that that's kind of, I would say, brings them forward when I'm talking. But then sometimes on my tours as a clairvoyant and I'm open, we'll have family members come up and kind of like be part of the tour. And that happened on my last tour, October 26th, which was the last Saturday tour that I gave in Salem. I had a grandmother, her name was Millie, of one of the guests or two of the guests that were there, like their grandmother was part of the group. And I'm like, there's this grandmother standing, but the older lady standing behind you, starts with an M. Like it literally like went from there. And like, oh my gosh, that's our grandma, Millie. Then when you have that kind of connection, it makes it a very profound experience for the people that are participating. Now, people watching that, it's not just, like, not their grandmother. Like, they're like, why? Like, they think it's crazy. But for the two people that had a grandmother that was part of the group, they were like, yes, yes. And I like was giving some backstory on this woman. She was like the life of the party. And so I do have both. I have, I would say I feel more comfortable connecting with witch trials victims because I feel like a strong connection to them, but I also get people's family members too.
What does it feel like for you when you're getting those messages, when you're getting the, I'm getting a letter M, I'm getting this woman was the life of a party, and you're giving these little tidbits, these little nuggets of information that pertain to that individual? What personally are you experiencing? Are you almost like seeing flashes of this person's life? Is it literally these words are coming to you and you're spitting them out? I've always been curious about that for someone who's going through that at that moment. What are you experiencing before you relay this information to the individuals?
Well, you know, it's different. Everybody has a different gift. And I would say that my gift is psychometry. So psychometry is where you touch an object. It could be a historical object. And you kind of, for me, I actually literally flash back in time and I can see things play out. With Millie specifically, she came to me in bits and pieces and I saw her in my third eye. And then it's kind of hard to explain what a third eye is, but you can like, literally see her. And as a clairvoyant, that's my tool, using that third eye to see what she looked like and kind of like who she, what kind of to give those tidbits about her. So for me, I can visually see her, and that's what clairvoyant means. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes I do get voices too. I'll hear a voice behind me in my ear. And usually that will give me like, and that's my spirit guide. And I have spirit guides too that give me information about people in the area. So it really depends. Like it's mm-hmm. kind of like this weird puzzle. And sometimes I'm like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And I have to figure out what the puzzle means.
It's almost, I'm just trying to communicate this to the audience so they can have a better understanding of it. Tell me if this analogy would be somewhat accurate. You go to an antique store that has old antique photos of people you know nothing about, but you can take a look at the photo. Let's say you pick one up for just 3 seconds. You take a look at the picture, you see what's going on in it, you see some faces doing something, you look at the back quick and you glance, there was a name written on the back. 5 minutes later, someone asks you, what was in that picture? And then you're trying to recount. Well, there was it was a woman. I think it started with an M. You know, she looked like this person was happy and smiling. And there was a party going on, if that's what the case was. Is that kind of like what you're recounting? It's these quick little glimpses into someone's life that you're validating who, in fact, is communicating that to you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that. There's a Disney show called That's So Raven, where she kind of like breathes in and kind of like flashes back. That's how I do it.
It's okay.
Kind of this, like my friends call it ghost face. So I do like a ghost face, uh-huh. And I'm like, and then I have a moment of like seeing what goes on, and then I spit it out. So it's usually it's not like later. It's like usually
right then.
When I have those ghost face moments, that's when I get the information. It's like a download almost.
Okay, I get you. I've made the download reference before too. And bonus points to you for making a legitimate That's So Raven reference on the program. I do a lot of just obscure pop culture references and 10 listeners will get it and I'll get emails all week about it. And I have just out of, you know, really a real serious story that someone has called in just to give a little comic relief sometimes on our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online, just because it's like, okay, take a breath. Oh my gosh, this was a heavy story. I'll just end the story with, that's so Raven. And then just jump into a more serious, heartfelt response. But sometimes that little breath there and the little bit of humor goes a long way. So you're the first person to ever jump into that. I'm just impressed. Anyhow, continuing on with our conversation about your experiences. Obviously, there was an episode of A Haunting that your experience was featured in, or one of your experiences was featured in. And I did have a chance to see a bit of it earlier in the day. This is, from what I understand, you were giving a performance or a tour of some sort was this in Salem?
Right. So it was in Topsfield, but that's one of the biggest misconceptions is that Salem was actually considered Danvers. So Salem Village was Danvers, Topsfield, PVD. So I was in an area where was considered Salem Village, but it was modern day Topsfield. It was called Pierce Farm at Witch Hill. And I mean, this is after giving tours all season in Salem. So I would actually do like typical tour season, and it was not ghost tours that year. It was all history tours. So I would not even bring up the ghosts. I would just talk about the history. And it was very safe for me to do that. And you were asking about the clairvoyant. This year is like the first year we're actually brought in that clairvoyant ability. It was actually kind of remarkable, but because I was having so many experiences, like the apple, like getting scratched. I had a situation where I had the number 8 branded on my chest, things like that. It was like really intense stuff when I was giving ghost tours. So I stopped giving the ghost tours for a couple of years. And then, this year was 3 years ago. And it actually, I would say like celebrating is not the right word. I dealt with the 3-year anniversary of this attachment. I was telling, so this is after a year of giving history tours with a heritage group that is based in Salem. And it was a very respected group of tours. And like they really, they viewed me as, I'm a historian, and they're like, no ghosts. So I'm like, they're like, but for this one night, we'll let you tell ghost stories. And I'm like, oh, great. This is awesome. So I was able to tell the story. And this location is very historic in the sense that it was owned by one of the Crown and Shields. And it had a history that was not only witch trials history, but there was also witch trials history there too, because Mary Easty, who was one of the three sisters who were accused of witchcraft, her sister was Rebecca Nurse, who was executed, and Mary Easty was executed too. That's where she hid before she actually was executed. That was where her son lived. So there was like the witch trials history plus the Crown and Shield history. So I was so entranced by the history of this beautiful mansion in Topsfield. So the goal for this evening was actually a fundraiser. And there was this, you dress up in steampunk, and so my garb was kind of like a throwback to the period that I was going to talk about, which was the 19th century, or specifically a case, the crime of the century from 1830. So I was telling the story of a murder of Captain Joseph White. He was bludgeoned to death it was a full moon on April 6, 1830, and it basically was considered the crime of the century because it was a major whodunit and inspired people like Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, and this beautiful mansion that still exists. And I actually would give tours, not inside the location, but outside, like during the day. So it was something I would tell over and over again. So I did this, but it was kind of like it was more of a theatrical performance in the sense that they wanted it to be kind of spooky. Mm-hmm. And so I did, I told the story, but I told it maybe a little bit more theatrically than I normally would tell about my tours. And so I was telling the story of Captain Joseph White getting murdered, and then I tell the story of the person who committed the murder, who was Richard Crowninshield. And Richard Crowninshield was the black sheep of this really well-off family in Salem, well-respected. He was an alcoholic. He definitely had issues with gambling. So he was like the black sheep of the Crown and Shield family. And so he was actually a murder for hire. So they, as in the people that paid for it, were affiliated with Captain Joseph White, and they wanted to murder him to get his money, to get his inheritance. So I kind of replay the murder. And then according to the episode of Haunting, they say that this is where it kind of gets a little messy when it goes to the actual what really happened. Mm-hmm. I was playing Richard Crowninshield. So when I say playing him, I was like a kind of being an actor telling the story. Like I'm Richard Crowninshield.
Sure.
And while I was doing that, I actually started trance channeling. Now, trance channeling is something I've never done before. Maybe when I was a kid. But I never did it to the point where I did it that night. And I didn't really know what was going on. All I knew, I was getting a lot of information from Richard Crowninshield. And so I was getting like downloads, like he was framed. So in these downloads, I was getting information that he did not commit the murder alone. He actually committed the murder. His brother was there. and things like that. It was like, I'm like, oh, this is so fascinating. So I was getting these downloads while I was telling the story. But meanwhile, I was basically channeling him, and he kind of took over.
That's going to wrap up part one of our interview with Sam Baltrisis and his experiences with the undead. In part two, what does it feel like for Sam when a spirit conveys information from the dead to the living? What kind of dark entity branded the number 8 on Sam's chest? What happened when Sam was giving a performance about a murder victim in Salem late one night? When Sam realized something was attached to him, how long was it there? And how did Sam find a way to remove the attached spirit from him? Is there anything Sam does now to defend himself from spiritual attachments? And did Sam experience a possession looking back at it, or was it something else? We'll discuss all that and more in part two of our interview, available to Gravekeepers. You become one at patreon.com/thegravetalks. Sign up for only $5 a month. You'll have access to part two of this interview, along with access to part two of all of our interviews. More than 100 episodes at patreon.com/thegravetalks, as well as access to advanced episodes of the program months before they're released to the public. patreon.com/thegravetalks for all of that and to help support this program and keep it on the air. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.